Elizabeth Barrett is a wife, mother, grandmother, licensed marriage and family therapist, educator, eavesdropper, and emotion worker. She uses all of these skills to address the subjects that we all grapple with in this conversation with the reluctant therapist. Happy Healthy Tuesday, Elizabeth.
Happy Healthy Tuesday, Francisco.
Where are we going? Thanks, Elizabeth. Where are we going today?
So today we are stepping into the space of opportunities to speak to your idols. That's the space that I'm in today. Also, because it's Women's History Month and yesterday was International Women's Day, I thought it was a perfect time to really immerse ourselves into the world of the feminine and to feminist theory and to kind of the world of the goddess and all of those things that are supported by Mother Earth and Mother Nature. So we have a fully feminine focused show today, but you're still welcome to be here. You're still welcome to be with us. But today's show started back in 1992. My daughter was taking a dance class and her teacher was wearing a beautiful necklace that looked kind of like this feminine form that I'd never seen anything like. And I just asked her, where did you get this? And she said, oh, this is the goddess Willendorf. I'd never heard of that. And she said, and I go to Pacifica Graduate Institute and I got this necklace there. And you know, when you hear a new word or you learn a new something, all of a sudden that something starts to snowball everywhere you look. And so having that conversation, this curiosity awoke inside of me that literally changed the course of my life. And so there was a full moon circle at Coalesce Bookstore. And at this bookstore, I found my first, you know, goddess necklace. And one of the women at the circle gave me a book called The Spiral Dance, written by Starhawk, who, inside scoop, is our guest today. But this book was given to me at this full moon ritual, nothing I'd ever experienced before. Meeting these women and hearing their stories just was so transformative, having grown up in a very competitive woman's world where all other women were your competition and, you know, women were each other's worst supporters. All of a sudden I was surrounded by women who were lifting each other up and talking about the beauty of their bodies and the power of being a woman and the power of childbirth and the beauty of, you know, our monthly periods. It was so new and transformative for me. And so that snowballed into being introduced to goddess spirituality and then the work of Jean Shinoda Bolen and Rhian Eisler and then my Mother Peace tarot card set and then the Wee Moon planners that started to be part of my life and then ultimately attending Pacifica Graduate Institute where I was just immersed in this world throughout all of my master's studies. And focused on feminist theory and feminist therapy was just really emerging at that time, which was a huge counter to the male-dominated lens that psychotherapy had been seen through since the beginning of psychotherapy and dealing with mental health. Very few programs were talking about dealing with mental health through the lens of a feminine or feminist perspective. And so at that point, there was no turning back for me. Just everything in my life keeps unfolding around these experiences. And it's when it first started, it was as if some truth had been, a truth had been awoken inside of me. And all of a sudden I was awakened to this story that had always lived inside of me, that had probably been in my bones from the moment I was born, but I needed to have something that woke that story up or that brought it to the forefront of my life, that changed my narrative and changed the way I operated in the world. And so that changed the way I operated with my children and bringing rituals into our family life. And someday I'll have the girls come on and talk about their coming of age ceremonies that they worked through in spite of, I'm sure, being horrified, but I hope they look back on fondly. And so throughout this course of my life since 1992, the work of my guest today, Starhawk, has influenced me in ways beyond just the spiral dance and goddess spirituality and feminine practice or feminist practices. But Starhawk has also, throughout her life, emerged into new truths. And one of them being the need for the work of permaculture in kind of reshaping our relationship to Mother Earth and finding a way of regeneration, remediation, and sustainability that will ensure that we have a planet and we have a quality of life for generations to come. So that's the story of how we got here. And I am excited to share this conversation today. This is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. You can join us on Instagram. We're doing Instagram Live today, and it looks like some people have jumped in. So welcome to Instagram Live. Just look for the reluctant therapist. You can follow us on Facebook. You can send me an email to Elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. You can listen to previous shows at kcbx.org. And if you'd like to stay on top of things, podcast our show, however you get your podcasts, and you'll be able to upload and listen at your convenience. So we're going to take a quick break, but we'll be back to start our conversation with Starhawk. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. Elizabeth Barrett. This is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. And Starhawk, welcome to the show. And thank you so much for spending some time with me.
Thank you, Elizabeth. It's a pleasure to be on.
So for those of you who don't know Starhawk, let me tell you just a bit about her work. Starhawk is an author, activist, permaculture designer and teacher, ritual maker, and has been a leader, founder, and now elder in modern earth-based spirituality and ecofeminism. Starhawk is also the author and co-author of 13 books, including Spiral Dance and The Fifth Sacred Thing. She founded Earth Activist Training, teaching permaculture design grounded in spirituality, utilizing the tools of ritual and the skills of activism. I could spend the entire hour reading all the other things you've done in your life, but maybe we'll touch on them as we start the story. So what started your path? I talked a little bit about seeing my friend's necklace. So what was your moment of awakening a different story?
Well, I grew up, I am the adult child actually of a therapist, actually of two therapists. My father was a group worker, but he died when I was five. And my mother was more of a psychotherapist, psychiatric social worker. She went back to work, and eventually she went back to graduate school when she was 50 and became an expert in grief and loss. So I kind of had that in my background. I always say my mother, you know, used to, instead of telling me bedtime stories, she'd tell me about her clients.
Yeah. Which can be better than bedtime stories.
A deep interest in understanding people and why they do the things they do. And just the realization that a lot of times why we do the things we do has deeper origins than what you see on the surface. And our family was Jewish, so I grew up with a lot of that background in education. But when I got to be a teenager, of course, it was the 60s, and there was all this exploration happening about different kinds of spirituality, Eastern, and different ways of reapproaching indigenous spirituality and reevaluating it, and magic, and I got very interested in all of those aspects of life. my friend Becky and I had a booth at the Renaissance Fair reading tarot cards when we were 15. I think we'd only learned to read tarot cards like a week before, but it didn't really stop us. And we were in the Witch's Woods and we met some people who called themselves witches and, you know, had all kinds of potions and things and, you know, cool stuff, right? And then when I was in my first year of college, another friend of mine and I did a project on witches for an anthropology class and met some people, including some of those original witches from the Witch's Woods. And they began telling us that witchcraft was not actually what people think it is. You know, it's not casting spells and doing hexes and making a pact with the devil. It was actually what was left of the pre-Christian religion of the goddess from Europe and from the Middle East. And to me, that was just a revelation. You know, in Judaism, God was always supposed to be neither female nor male, or, you know, completely a spirit and unformed, but God was always he in the Bible and always referred to as he. And the rabbis were always men. And at that point, there weren't any real roles for women in the tradition, except maybe being a Hebrew school teacher or the helpmate of a man. And the idea that there were ancient religions of the goddess where the divine was seen in female form, where I felt like I had a kind of representation I had never actually really imagined, that was illuminating. And then a few years later, the feminist movement began, the second wave of it, and women began organizing and talking about how do we become the agents of our own liberation. And I thought, well, there must be some connection between a religion of the goddess and women's liberation. Mm-hmm. Now, at the time, it seemed like at first I was the only person who thought that, because most of the feminist movement was very, you know, anti anything religious. Religion was the opiate of the people. Religion was oppressive. But I met other people along the way who had similar insights, like Z Budapest. I lived in L.A. at the time, and she had a whole large group she called the Susan B. Anthony Coven Number One. And then I moved to the Bay Area and met a lot of other people. And many of us were kind of coming out of the political movements of the 60s. Many of us had been anti-war activists and peace activists. And some of the people who were a little older than I was had been involved in civil rights activism. I was like 12, 13 years old when the freedom rides and things were happening. And I remember begging my mother, saying, I want to go. And she's like, you can't go.
It's not your time.
Yeah. And I remember her telling me, like, there would still be things to protest when I grew up.
Yes, and was she so right?
She was so right about that. And so we started a group to explore doing rituals and creating rituals and bringing together this ancient understanding of the goddess, or at least what was left of it, what we could discover about it, with our own current progressive vision for the world and feminist sensibilities and creativity. And eventually that became a group we called Reclaiming, that now has kind of become a tradition. It's really a very decentralized but extended network that has groups in the U.S. and Canada and Europe and Brazil and Australia and all over the place.
You mentioned that finding information about the history of the goddess in civilization was part of the challenge. And I think it led to you working on three different films, the Spirituality Trio of Films, The Goddess Remembered and The Burning Times. And so how did this information, you know, one, where did it go and how was it uncovered? Because I think Maria Gamboudas had something to do with that, but how is this
yes.
information recaptured?
Well, in the 70s, when I was starting, there was not very much. There was Robert Graves' book, The White Goddess. And I remember my first teachers recommending that and reading that when I was 17. And, you know, Robert Graves assumes everybody had like a British classical education of the early 1900s. A lot of it was way beyond me, but fascinating, you know, his idea that there was an ancient goddess that underlay the poetic traditions of Western Europe. And then there were other books, mostly some of the Jungian books that talked about the goddess. There were Joseph Campbell's books on different kinds of mythology. But Merlin Stone published a book, I think, in 1976 called When God Was a Woman that was full of information. It was fascinating. And my book, The Spiral Dance, and Margot Adler's book, Drawing Down the Moon, were both published in 79. But then in the 80s, there was a big outpouring both of research and scholarship and literature. And Maria Gimbutas, who was an archaeologist, eventually she was the head of the Department of Indo-European Studies at UCLA. She published a book which was first called The Gods and Goddesses of Ancient Europe, of Old Europe. Later she changed it to The Goddesses and Gods of Old Europe. And then a number of others, The Language of the Goddess and The Civilization of the Goddess. And her books were very affirming, because she actually could demonstrate from the archaeological record some of the things that we were talking about that had come down as lore or through mythology or through rereading of old fairy tales or, you know, or sheer just guesswork. And she was a huge influence on the goddess movement. She got a lot of flack for her work. She was very well respected as long as she was dealing with chieftains and kings and swords and the Bronze Age. But when she went deeper than that, and when she started to say, you know, there was at the roots of civilization, even in Europe, you know, there were cultures that lived close to the land that where the deity or the sense of the sacred was about not about killing or about command and control structures, but was really about growth and birth and the cycles of birth and death and renewal. And Joan Marler, who's a wonderful scholar of Maria's work, always says Maria would say, it's not about fertility, it's about regeneration. And I think that is so key to understanding both what those ancient traditions were about, that vision of the world as a cycle where death leads on to a different form of renewal. And also I think it's really key to what we need in the world today.
If you're just tuning in, my guest is Star Hawk, so author, activist, permaculture designer and teacher, ritual maker, leader, founder, and now an elder in our modern earth-based spirituality movement and the understanding of ecofeminism. And if you don't know that definition, ecofeminism is a philosophical and political movement that combines ecological concerns with feminist concerns and challenging the masculine domination of society. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. And so Starhawk, you know, everything kind of seems to coalesce around this almost this reawakening of the feminine energy that was buried or tried to be buried or the narrative retold. So the reawakening of that, and along with that, the reawakening of the need for our reconnection to Mother Earth and to sustainability. It was almost like the patriarch took over and wiped out everything in its path through rage and aggression and domination. And now, just when things are falling apart, the reemergence of the feminine in the 1970s and this movement towards trying to bring about regeneration. And you're at the forefront of that. So how is this? Are you tired? How has this process been for you?
I mean, I feel like I've lived a very privileged, charmed life in that I've gotten to do the work that I love pretty much all of my life. So I can't say that I'm tired, although I have to admit I don't have quite the physical capacities I might once have had.
And then you get to turn it in for just, you get to be the crone. And
Yeah, but as you get older, what you find is that the things that were optional, you know, like in my 20s, it was great if I got exercise. But now that I'm almost 70, if I don't get exercise, my blood sugar goes up, my cholesterol goes up, I'm on the verge of getting diabetes. You know, when I was in my 20s, I could do yoga or not do yoga. And now I remember my advisor, Ani Mander, in the therapy program I eventually went to. I got a degree in psychology with a feminist therapy concentration back in the 80s. And she had written a wonderful book called Feminism as Therapy. Mm-hmm. But I remember coming to visit her, and she was doing yoga, and her looking at me and saying, yeah, when you get a few years older, you realize you have to do this.
Or you can't get out of bed in the morning.
Exactly. Yeah. Or you just like all stiffen up altogether. So
with spiral dances, to kind of tie things in, what, when you wrote that book, what was your hopes? Were you hoping to lead a spiritual movement? Was it just to get this off your chest? What was the vision for that work?
Well, I never imagined I would lead a spiritual movement. When I was writing it, I was more concerned whether anybody would ever read it at all. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I had written other things, a couple of novels that I had never succeeded in getting published. So just writing a book that was able to get out in the world was a big goal. But I had been exploring spirituality, and so had other people in my circles and my friends. So I wanted to kind of record what we were exploring and learning about and thinking about. And eventually I did find a wonderful editor, Marie Cantlon, who at that time, it was Harper and Row, and they had opened a branch in San Francisco called Harper San Francisco to really explore the new spiritual movements that were happening out on the West Coast. And Marie was a very supportive editor and really helped me structure the book. And that eventually came out in, as I said, in 1979. And then that opened up other possibilities for me of speaking and teaching and leading things. But I always saw spirituality as something, as trying to kind of get away from the idea of the spiritual leader or the great teacher or the great man. It was always, you know, a great man that reveals the truth. And into something, again, out of that feminist understanding of collectivity, you know, that we were affirming each person's spiritual authority, and we had groups that made decisions together by consensus, and that rotated roles of leadership, and that rotated opportunities to, you know, the fun part of rituals, being creative and, you know, coming up with new ideas for it and new chants and new forms of worship, and to spread that around so it didn't all come from one person.
Which is what was so fascinating for me because I had grown up in the traditional Catholic world. And so this idea that we would take our own spiritual journey into our own hands and create their own rituals seemed so blasphemous and scary at first. Like, who am I to think that I can, you know, tap into the great universal energy? But to be in these groups of women who are all feeling that same empowered sense of being their own religious, their own personal religious leader. Did you get pushback from that, from, I don't know, people in the community? Because that was a huge change in what spiritual lives looked like.
There were times when we would get some pushback, but mostly I was actually surprised at how much support and affirmation I got. At one period in my life, I taught for about 10 or 15 years in Matthew Fox's Institute of Culture and Creation Spirituality. Mm-hmm. And he was he began as a Dominican who was really opening up a way for the church to refocus away from sin and redemption and into the idea of God as the creator, as really valuing creation. And I remember when he first wrote to me, you can tell how long ago this was because he sent me an actual physical letter. And I saw it said something about creation spirituality, and I thought he must be a creationist, you know, one of those people that don't believe in Darwin. I was like, why is this guy writing to me? Like, but then when I read it, I realized, oh, we're very much, again, in aligned paths. And, you know, in that program, many of the people who took the course were nuns or priests or ministers coming out of much more traditional religion. And again, I was amazed at the kind of support I got. And I think it was also supportive. Like, I'll never forget one day we had created a ritual for the class, and I was kind of assigning roles and was saying, like, okay, you'll do this and you'll do that. And you'll be the priestess of the seeds and you'll carry the bowl of seeds around. And this woman looking at me going like, priestess of the seeds. Priest, I've been in the Catholic Church. We've been fighting for decades to try to get women to be able to become priests. And this is the first time, like, I'm going to be a priestess of the seeds. And it was such an amazing thing for her.
Yeah.
And that kind of thing would happen over and over again.
So. Well, it must be, again, that sense of tapping into something that all of a sudden actually feels true when you've been playing along and trying to go along with the narrative of our culture because everyone else seems to follow it. But then when you tap into something that actually feels right, it's freeing. And I think that, I think that's what my experience finding your book and finding this path was like, oh wait, this makes sense. And so many other things didn't. And it's interesting that you mentioned Michael, because he also was on the show and we talked about that the energy river, and that each religion kind of stands over the pot that leads into the spiritual river, and that each religion has, you know, only so much entrance into the spiritual river for each person. And so when you look at the goddess spirituality, that's the only one that you tap directly into the spiritual river without some sort of guide or, you know, a rabbi or a priest kind of blocking the path into that flow, which always stood with me. If you're just tuning in, my guest today is Starhawk. She's an author, activist, permaculture designer. We're going to spend the next half hour talking about her movement into the world of permaculture and how it connects to her early work as a founder and now elder in our modern earth-based spirituality movements. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back. To continue our conversation, you're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
You're listening to Public Radio for the Central Coast, KCBX. Coming up at 3 o'clock is Fresh Air, followed by Marketplace at 4, and All Things Considered at 4:30. If you'd like to send any questions to our guest today, you can give us a call at 805-549-8855, and we'll relay them to our guests today. You're listening to a conversation with the reluctant therapist. Elizabeth, back to you.
Thank you, and thank you, Starhawk, for spending this hour with us today. And I want to dive into permaculture. For people who aren't familiar with the term, I'll just my brief definition, and you can educate me further, that permaculture is a system of ecological design, designing self-sustaining systems in ways that forests are self-sustaining or meadows are self-sustaining. Permaculture is a way that we become connected to the way the indigenous land was always meant to be, and not the way Western civilization tried to come in and control the earth and bend it to their desires. Permaculture is about understanding that we are the earth and need to work within the systems of the earth. How's that for a start?
Yeah, that's pretty good. Yeah.
So how did you even find your way into the world of permaculture?
Well, I began, I was sometime in the 80s, I had a friend who had taken a permaculture design course, and she started telling me about it, and I was fascinated. And at the time, I was starting to write The Fifth Sacred Thing, which is a novel, a visionary novel set in the mid-21st century, and trying to imagine what a society would be like if we actually achieved an ecological balance. So I started reading and learning about it. I've always loved gardening and always loved connecting to nature. And permaculture offered a really good structure and framework for understanding the science of it, as well as understanding the wisdom in some of the traditional indigenous practices and traditional land use practices, and create a very powerful synthesis. It was started in the 70s by two Australian academics, Bill Mollison and David Holmgren, as a way of trying to say what would happen if we could do agriculture in a way that actually regenerated environmental systems instead of destroying them. And it's become a worldwide movement of people practicing it all over the globe, really. You know, it's from homesteaders to places in Africa where it's become a way of organizing whole regions to revitalize their landscape and their communities, or India, where people are working with hundreds of thousands of farmers. And it's very much allied to the whole larger regenerative agriculture movement and agroecology. They're all sort of overlapping systems.
So what does that look like as far as someone said, I'm going to change my backyard into a permaculture system and not a traditional garden?
Well, if any of you are watching this on Instagram, you can see my Mediterranean food forest as my background there. But it's often a way, you know, we say it's less a set of techniques than it is a set of ethics and principles.
Okay.
The ethics being to care for the earth, care for the people, and to care for the future, to understand that we need to limit our consumption and return back to the system what we take from it. To me, those were entirely compatible with the ethics of goddess spirituality and earth-based spirituality. And the same kinds of understandings when we would say from a spiritual perspective, everything is interconnected, and from a permaculture perspective, we'd say the same thing. Everything is interconnected, and here's how it all works. So it seemed to me to be the practical application of the idea that the earth is sacred, you know, the how-to part.
Yeah, and that's what seems so beautiful, because I heard you say in your talk at the Harvard Divinity School that permaculture is the intersection of the sacred, the spiritual, and the ecological. coming together. So all of the work you had done building kind of your spiritual foundation now is being manifested in a way of actually healing Mother Earth. And you talk in that about edges. Can you talk about edges as it is connected to permaculture and other systems?
Yeah, edges is one of the principles. It's an ecological principle, really, that the edges between two different systems in ecology, it's called the ecotones, are actually a system in itself that often is more dynamic. So it can be more creative, it can be more diverse, it can have has more niches, different niches in it that generate different possibilities for life. So if you think about where the ocean meets the shore, you get the tidal zone that has so many different qualities, some areas that are dry most of the time and maybe wet once a year, some that are wet and maybe only, you know, surface once a year, some that go from wet to dry, you know, twice a day, some that are rocky and some that are sandy. And so you get this tremendous diversity of living organisms that respond to those different conditions. And the same kind of principle applies, I believe, socially, you know, that we get two different groups of people or two different systems meeting. And, you know, I think about that edge where African music met European music and gave us blues and gospel and jazz and hip hop and rock and roll and so many different creative forms. So when we understand that, and it's kind of related to the principle that in natural systems, diversity creates resilience. If you have a prairie that has 400 different types of plants every square yard, and you get a bug or a disease, that prairie has a tremendous ability to resist that. Whereas if you replace that with a field of genetically engineered identical corn and Roundup spray everything else out of there, that corn is completely vulnerable to any kind of pest or any kind of disease that might come through. So in permaculture, we think about that. We say, how do we design systems that are diverse rather than monocultures, polycultures? How do we design systems where there are lots of different edges, different places where different systems meet, so we can take advantage of that richness? And I think if we applied that to our human systems, instead of looking at other groups that might be different than us and saying, oh no, they're a threat, we should wipe them out, you know, we might look at it and say, oh, the more diversity that we have, you know, if we succeeded in this country of creating a truly, you know, racially, gender diverse system where everyone actually had full opportunity to develop to their fullest potential, that would make us tremendously more resilient and more creative and open up all kinds of possibilities we can hardly even imagine now. Think what it would be like if we didn't have to spend all this energy countering systems of oppression, right?
And building systems of opportunity. Mm-hmm. And you had talked about how, you know, everything being interconnected was kind of this new awakening, which I find fascinating because in the world of psychotherapy, no one talked about the interconnectedness of humans or families until the 1950s when we started talking about systems mm-hmm. therapy. And that built off of early ecosystems understandings that, you know, when a pond is fouled, it ruins the wildlife. That wasn't discovered until the 1930s or 40s. It amazes me how long it's taken us as human beings to awaken to the fact that nothing stands alone and that it has to be looked at as a whole, that we can't look at anyone or anything as a single thing, like a single crop or a single person, mm-hmm. that we're all part of something greater. And so you talked about how when we look at permaculture or permanent culture, the way that we can grow agriculture that is sustainable, that you can also apply that to social permaculture and economic permaculture. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so I would say, you know, that Indigenous people understood this. I mean, you can't really talk about Indigenous people as if they were all one thing, because there are thousands and thousands of Indigenous cultures. But I think most of them had in common this understanding, again, of interconnectedness at the root. Mm-hmm. And then Western science, as it developed, kind of went into this idea of, well, we're going to break things down into their component parts and delve into them and separate them out so we can understand them better. And, you know, there's power to that idea. There's a lot. We wouldn't be talking right now over the internet if Western science didn't work, right?
Exactly.
It's given us a tremendous amount of potential and tools. But it kind of lost track for a while of that idea of those interconnected connections. And then really in the 20th century, as science, you know, physicists as far back as the 1920s, as they took the atom and tried to break it into smaller and smaller pieces and go, well, what is the smallest piece of stuff? And you get down to the small and you realize it's actually a set of relationships.
It's still connections.
Yeah. And then other, you know, the whole science of ecology and the understanding of systems and systems theory and thinking and its application in many different walks of life, including psychotherapy, started to arise in the mid-century. And I think we're still in the process of making the shift from looking at the world as a bunch of separate, isolated objects, like a big clock, to understanding it more like a living organism and all that complexity.
My guest today is Starhawk. I'm Elizabeth Barron, and this is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. And mm-hmm. So part of your work in the last 20 years, if not more, was creating earth activist training. And what mm-hmm. inspired you to take this on? Because you've graduated over 1,000 people into the world of earth activism. So what is that for you, and how does that work?
Well, it is our permaculture training program. Originally, it was started by myself and Penny Livingston Stark. In 1999, we were both at this big blockade in Seattle against the World Trade Organization. That was countering the neoliberalist agenda of, you know, sort of reducing, you know, of austerity and reducing what governments did for people and getting rid of any kind of restrictions on corporations and letting them roam the globe freely to find the cheapest place to produce stuff with the least environmental regulations. And that was a very inspiring action for everyone who took part in it. And afterwards, as we were talking about what we could do and maybe how we serve this incredible community of young activists that had risen up, and we decided to do a program that would help teach permaculture, help give activists a sense of what the solutions are, mm-hmm. and also help challenge some of our permaculturalists to understand some of the power relations that were standing in the way of putting those solutions into practice. So we began teaching permaculture design courses that had a grounding in spirit and a focus on organizing and activism. And called it Earth Activist Training.
And where?
Which has a nice acronym of EAT, which we like to do.
Because after you've grown all of this beautiful food, then you nourish the soul.
Yeah, exactly.
And so
we've taught that in California, where I'm based, but also in other places, from Canada to England, I was able to teach a course in Egypt last year before COVID. I've taught in the occupied West Bank of Palestine, in Germany and Spain, in France. So it's been a real wonderful adventure.
And I would imagine.
And of course, in this last year with COVID, what we've done is we have put pretty much everything online for the duration. So we've been teaching a permaculture design course online. We're just launching advanced courses in permaculture and regenerative land management. That'll be starting at the end of this month for people who've done a permaculture design course. And we have many other courses that we're able to offer. So in permaculture, we say the problem is the solution. And the problem of COVID and not being able to teach in person has maybe been the solution to expanding and making these programs available more widely by being able to use this amazing online technology. We have a community called online.earthactivisttraining.org, and we have a website that has all of our stuff on. That's earthactivisttraining.org.
Yes, earthactivisttraining.org says that you have a free community webinar coming up about the elements of resilience on March 15th from 6 to 7:30. So kind of an overview of the possibilities, because it seems one of the benefits, hidden benefits of COVID is that people have taken to their backyards more because they've been home and had this opportunity to kind of engage in the earth and putting their hands in the earth and getting down and dirty with the soil. And one of the things you talked about, and I can't remember which of the things that I was watching you talk about, was how we separate people from the earth by categorizing those who work with the earth and, you know, care for others and get down and do that dirty work is somehow less valuable to our culture than those who work in kind of the ethereal world.
Yes, I think it's part of an overarching frame in our culture that really goes back to that separation of the spiritual and the actual physical material world that took the sacredness out of earth and nature and said, well, God is something outside the world and nature and earth is somehow suspect and probably sinful. And so we have this split. You know, the metaphors embedded in our language where we'll say, you know, we are going to the light, or, you know, going over to the dark side where light is good and dark is evil. And it reflects in racism, in seeing white people as good and dark people as suspect. It's linked to sexism because all the, you know, because women are embodied, you know, all that birth and blood and flesh and stuff of actual living and bringing life into the world is somehow suspect and devalued. And what's high and removed from that and spiritual is something that's out of this world and disconnected. And then it reflects on how we view labor. You know, so that people who actually work with their hands or actually produce things that sustain life, like farmers and farm workers. I mean, we can see that right now where we are so dependent on the frontline workers who deliver food and provide groceries in this pandemic. And, you know, the actual caregivers who've taken care of people who have COVID, the nurses and the doctors and the health workers, and how hard it's been to even get something like a living wage for those people that we're utterly dependent on. And at the same time, people who do nothing but really manipulate figures, you know, right? You know, abstractions like are raking in trillions and
Yeah, somehow we've moved to this the less you can do, the more you are valued in society. And those with skills are considered to be throwaways. So I want to mention some of the other things that are coming up because I just want people to get excited about seeing the world through a different lens. On the 14th, you're actually partnering with Rianne Eisler, who we mentioned earlier, doing a program called The Four Cornerstones, an alternative Passover ritual exploring modern day liberation. And this is a fundraiser in one part to raise funds to stop trafficking in India. But the conversation about a ritual exploring modern day liberation, what do you think is going to come up for that conversation? What excites you about that?
Well, it's a wonderful group of myself, Rianne, and two other women who are rabbis and another woman who's a wonderful musician. For me, it's part of exploring what we call our Jewish community, our pagan roots that connect to my Jewish ancestry. And Rianne has a formulation, a new book on the four cornerstones that she sees as really key to transformation, looking at gender and children and economics and storytelling. So each, and in the Seder, there's four questions that are traditional that get asked. So we're each taking one of those and creating a ritual piece around it and a question that we'll leave people with. And we're thinking of it. It's not, it's actually a week or so before Passover starts. So you can think of it as your Passover prep work.
So you're prepared when it actually starts. Yeah. And the idea of ritual kind of leads me to the other thing I want to talk about, which is your magical activism series, which is this year-long monthly live ritual series that started in January, but people can still participate in, where you're going to do kind of a combination of talking about permaculture, but also the sacred and the rituals. And in our last few minutes, I'd like to talk about the importance of those rituals because I'm moving into my 60th year, which feels like a huge transition. I feel pulled to the earth and I feel pulled to ritual. And I'm wondering how that plays in your life, because it seems like everything you do is around a ritual of some sort. And is that by design or is that by nature?
Probably some of both, but I find ritual is important. You know, it's a way of engaging multiple parts of yourself, not just the intellectual, but the emotional, the sensual, into an experience or a change or a transformation. So, you know, for example, every morning I wake up and I stretch because, as I said, you have to, right? but I also have a gratitude practice where I try to begin the day by thinking of five things to be grateful for. I connect with nature. I spend some time sitting and just watching and looking and listening and hearing what the natural world has to tell me. I do some healing for people I know in my life who need healing, especially since COVID. Mm-hmm. And what I find is all of those things have an impact on me. If I wake up in a terrible mood thinking, and this bad and that bad, and this isn't work, then that shifts by doing those practices. And when we do collective ritual together, it can be a way of facing together things that are either too challenging to face alone or too hard to face alone, or are things that we want acknowledged and celebrated. It gives value to an experience. So if you think about it, when somebody dies, there's a kind of universal need to do something to memorialize that person. To honor their life in some way and to say this life was important, this life mattered.
In some ways, it feels like the vaccination rollouts are a ritual in some way, like a collective ritual. And the last thing I want to bring up is that you had posted a picture of you proudly getting your second vaccine and promptly got skewered by your followers. And then you came back and talked about why, it was important for you. And can you briefly just, I loved what you said about why you feel the vaccine was important.
Yeah, I mean, I will say of all the people who skewered me, I kept looking and I don't actually know any of them. Everyone I actually know was positive and supportive, right? But I was saying, you know, you can be a spiritual person. You can believe that there's more to science. You know, there's more to the world than just, the quantification of science and that breaking things down to parts, but still acknowledge all the good things that it has gotten us. And that you don't have to, for me, Earth-based spirituality has never been about a dogma or a belief system. It's been about experience. You know, it's not that I have to believe in some unseen thing. It's that I can look outside and I can see a leaf fall and it falls to earth and it decays and becomes compost and feeds the roots of that tree. And then I can experience that whole process, that cycle, with awe and reverence and amazement. And then the more science I know about it, the more it deepens my understanding of it. And, you know, as far as the vaccine goes, like, I'm almost 70 years old. I have asthma. I am not exactly like a slim thing. Right? I have all kinds of things that, you know, have been shown to be factors for possibly getting a very severe case of the disease. We know the disease impacts people and can have horrific side effects. And there's just no doubt about that, let alone, you know, a death. So weighing that against the slight probability that there might be some long-term side effects of the vaccines we don't know about, there might be, but you know, looking at both of them, I have to say, hey, if this can protect me and also help protect someone else against my possibly giving them the disease and help ease the burden on our healthcare workers who are, you know, stressed and exhausted after all of this time.
You had to do your part.
Our
hour went too fast, Starhawk, because I have this list of questions. I just want people to know, learn more about Starhawk. Go to info@earthactivisttraining.org. Look into her live ritual series, Magical Activism. I will be there in March, so I'll look for you there. And I hope that we'll get to have another conversation. Thank you to my listeners. Thank you to the Instagram Live followers. We will have information up if you want to find out more things are going on. Starhawk, thank you for your time.
Thank you. Yeah, starhawk.org is a great place to go for all of it and for the magical activism. And thank you. It's great to talk to a reluctant therapist.
Thank you. And thank you for tuning in and listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.